Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. As you know, we've had a slight panel change, but we're ready to proceed with the second case that we have set for argument this afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Kerr. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right is Justice Wade Bodwell. I understand that counsel have all checked in, and appellant wants 15 and 5 for your split on time. So without further ado, if the clerk would call the case. Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Marriott. I'm arguing on behalf of Mr. Richard Crawford. Mr. Crawford is the reported owner of an 8.235 acre tract in Tarrant County.
Let me interrupt you just for a second because this air conditioning behind us, you probably can't hear it out there, but it's really, really loud. If you could just speak up a tiny bit, that would help us old people on the panel.
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Crawford is the owner of an 8.235 acre tract of land to which he has for the mineral estate. This court has recently addressed the strip and gore doctrine in Green v. Chesapeake. However, while the law may be the same in each of these cases, the facts are very different, and the cases focused on different aspects of the strip and gore doctrine. In Green, the landowner argued that the tract was not conveyed because it was not small in size in comparison to the tract that was described as conveyed. In the Crawford tract, the situation is that the tract did not cease to be of benefit or importance to my client's predecessor. In 1964, Mary Ruth Crawford owned fee simple to a tract of land. That same year, she sold the Crawford tract down the center of that tract of land to Texas Electric Service Company. In that deed, she reserved oil and gas and waived conditionally the right to access the surface of that land for exploration. The exact language of the reservation is that the grantors expressly waive all rights of ingress and egress for the purpose of drilling for or producing oil and or gas from the surface of the lands herein conveyed, provided that wells opened on other lands may be bottomed on these lands.
What means at the time of that conveyance in 1964 would there have been for bottoming a well from other lands in that particular mineral interest underneath that tract?
In that particular mineral interest, had Mary Ruth Crawford chosen to do so, she could have drilled a well on the adjacent tracts that she still owned. She could have drilled a well on a nearby tract that she leased from someone else, and drilled a well at a slant hole into the bottom of the tract that she owned.
Were there any properties, I mean, is there anything in the record that indicates the nature of the slant well? There's a citation with regard to, I believe in your brief, with regard to bottom, what it means to bottom, and that includes deviated or slant well drilling, okay? And there's a discussion of that in that particular Supreme Court case. And so my question is, since she's clearly conditioned her waiver on a particular form of development and production of that mineral, should we not be looking at whether or not that type of access was actually available in either 1964 or 1984?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it matters whether that particular means of access was particularly available, because the conditional nature of the waiver means that if that form of access was not available, then she would regain access to the surface. In one way or another, she would have some form of access if she chose to exercise it. And this access of mineral rights is owned by every single person that owns mineral rights and has not waived that surface access.
Well, the reason I ask that is that if, in fact, what we're dealing with is a provision whereby she was anticipating the possibility of drilling either a slant well or a deviated well, and I'm not sure I'm using that last term correctly, but anyway, that being said, there had to have been certain limitations on the availability of that type of drilling, and most probably those limitations would have included some degree of contiguousness with regard to the other land. In other words, she wouldn't be able to drill a slant well across the county to access that particular mineral interest. So it's likely we're looking for intent here. It's likely that the waiver is conditioned on some type of drilling from her own land that she maintained for the next 20 years. And if that's true, then why don't we infer that when she conveyed the only land that she anticipated drilling a slant well from, why don't we think that that means that she basically was conveying the rights underneath the surface of the tract in question?
We don't, because there's no evidence in the record that the only property she anticipated being able to drill from was the property she owned. And further, if that was the case and she was only able to drill from her property, then at the time she conveyed that property, she would not be able to bottom the wells from that land and so would regain the right to access the surface and drill from the surface and produce minerals. This conditional waiver should be construed in a manner to encourage production.
How would she have access to the surface to drill if she had sold the land from which she would have had that access?
Because under Texas law, the mineral estate is the dominant estate and has the right to enter onto the surface and produce and explore for minerals. The only way that right would not be accessible is if that waiver continued in effect. And so if the waiver ceases to be in effect, then she is able to enter the surface. And unlike many strip and gore cases involving roads or canals or railroads, this is a power line. The surface of the land is not necessarily inaccessible entirely. It's not as if she would have to drill through a road to get to it.
Wouldn't she have to have something in the 64 deed, though, that would have indicated that she would have access through the access available by Tesco? In other words, in 1984, she conveys everything she's got in the north and the south contiguous acres. Okay, there's nothing said whatsoever about any access to either the surface or the mineral estate in the right-of-way that had been conveyed to Tesco. Okay, so if we're following Green and accessibility is what we're looking at in terms of whether or not there's some type of value, she has no access whatsoever through the land she's just conveyed in 84, the north or the south, okay? And on top of that, she would have to access the right-of-way in what manner?
Mrs. Crawford would be able to access the right-of-way through the road that borders that land. The tract that she owned was bordered on at least the east side by a road. And the right-of-way, not the right-of-way actually, the separate tract, but the separate tract borders that road. And so if Mary Ruth Crawford was unable to access the minerals from wells on other lands...
So she can access it from Matlock Road?
Yes.
Okay.
But the distinction between a right-of-way and a separate tract is very important in this case because it shows what is truly required for an intent to be broadened to include the separate tract. If it's a right-of-way and the question is the centerline presumption, then the question is what what does the tract being conveyed consist of? But in this case, because there is a separate tract, the issue is more clearly, did she intend to convey that separate tract? And in Cantley v. Gulf Production Company in 1940, the Texas Supreme Court held that if there is no benefit or importance to such a tract, then there is no reason not to convey it. So it stands to reason that if there is no cessation of benefit or importance, then there is reason for her not to have conveyed it. And she did not describe the land as being conveyed.
So you're saying the 1964 conveyance created this importance in her mind for that mineral tract, and we're assuming that that importance transmuted 20 years later when she made the 1984 conveyance? Or are you saying that because we're supposed to infer the importance by virtue of the fact that she was restored to the ability to explore that mineral tract?
The ability to explore the mineral tract is not what gives the minerals their importance. Minerals have inherent benefit and importance to their owners. Texas law has long recognized that whether a mineral interest is developed or not, the chance to develop it and extract what can be extracted is a valuable property right. It's worth something.
So because she made this reservation in 1964 and didn't mention it at all in 1984, we're assuming that her intent was still there to retain that tract.
Yes, because if she had intended to convey the tract in 1984, then she would have stated that she was conveying it. And she had and there was not a cessation of benefit or importance that would allow us to assume that she intended to convey it.
Except for the fact that she didn't reserve any right to access the tract through the north or south properties that she was conveying. If she really wanted access to it, she would have put that in her conveyance in 84, would she not?
We don't know that. And the fact is, it wasn't necessary. She could access it from the road, and she did not need the adjacent mineral tracts to have access to the Crawford tract. And if she didn't need access, and the tract was not being described as being conveyed, then what was there to reserve? If she had described the entire whole that she owned before in 1964, and then said, I'm conveying all that I own here, then she would have needed to reserve the Crawford tract. But she didn't do that. She described two separate tracts that did not include the disputed tract.
Okay, so basically she's the one who creates the impossibility of drilling down bottom, drilling a well that bottoms out underneath that, because she sells the only contiguous property from which that actually can occur.
No, Your Honor, because the well was eventually drilled from off of that property. At the time, she may not have considered it, but it could still occur.
Okay, now, are the four wells that are discussed in the briefing, are all four of those accessed through the surface of the right-of-way? That's not my understanding.
No, Your Honor.
There were wells that were drilled elsewhere out of that unit, but there was a pooling situation there as well.
Yes, that is correct. The pooling of the wells and the perforation below the Crawford tract may not be exactly what Mrs. Crawford imagined when she discussed bottoming from other lands, but it was the type of drilling that is overall contemplated, accessing that land from another site.
Well, actually, by that particular proviso, she's actually excluding pooling, because she's drilling from one part of the property into the bottom of the property she's conveyed where the mineral interest is. And that doesn't require pooling. Pooling would be something somebody else's, like what actually occurred here, some other property, okay? But those wells, the pooling wells in this case, my understanding, I can be corrected, those were not bottomed in this particular property. Pooling is a totally different aspect of this that doesn't appear to be contemplated by the exception to the waiver that she created.
That is not correct, Your Honor. The wells were drilled off of her tract. However, they were horizontal drill. They were horizontal well bores that went down through the entire tract and passed through and perforated the Crawford tract in multiple locations. And so under, I believe it is Lukey.
Okay, now I want to make sure what you're, these were not drilled from the surface of the Crawford tract, correct? They were not drilled in the right of way.
Correct.
They were drilled someplace else.
Correct.
Okay. And then there was some type of horizontal drilling that perforated through the Crawford tract?
Yes, Your Honor. The wells were drilled off-site, and then drilled laterally across the entire pooling area.
How long was the, not that it really matters legally, but how long was the lateral line that ended up going under the Crawford tract? Where did it originate? Okay. I'll tell you what. You can have 60 seconds to wrap up, and then if you'll add a minute to the appellee's time, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. When it comes down to it, the tract did not cease to be a benefit or importance because access in some form or another did remain, and the wells were physically bored underneath her property, and the well bores were perforated under her property to allow oil and gas resources to flow into those lines and back to the well sites.
But the horizontal drilling did not bottom in her property.
It would be bottoming in her property because the well bores were perforated and punctured in her property to allow the oil and gas minerals to come into her property. Bottoming a well is to open it up to allow the minerals to flow into the line. And because of the lack of benefit or importance, the strip and gore doctrine does not apply, the presumption does not arise, and the property was never conveyed in the first place, and we'd ask this court to reverse and remand.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Johnson.
Please, the court, counsel. I have a little board for you because I think in any kind of real estate case, it's always nice to have a picture of the real estate. I will say, first of all, that the record doesn't indicate where the well bore is, how long it is, whether it bottomed out in this easement. It is clear that it was not drilled in the actual easement area. And I say it's not really an easement. If you look at the bottom picture, that's the picture of the strip. And in 1963, Ms. Crawford owned just an undivided tract. 64, she transferred the yellow portion to Tesco to put up a high voltage power line. It's about a 50-yard easement. And in that, she reserved her oil and gas rights, not minerals, not water, not sulfur, not anything else, just oil and gas. But she waived her right to access in that tract. 20 years later, Ms. Crawford signs a deed with third parties to build homes, presumably, north and south of this yellow tract. And this 84 deed is what's, in my opinion, the most important thing in this case. You have to judge her intent, as it were, as of 1984. And at that time, she did not reserve any of the mineral rights under this north or south tracts that she transferred. She didn't reserve any of the minerals or oil and gas under the Tesco tract. She didn't reference strip and gore doctrine, or say it didn't apply. In that time period, there was basically no oil and gas development in Tarrant County, for the most part, in 1984, and certainly nothing in Arlington.
We only know that, though, because of Mr. McGregor's affidavit. Is that correct?
Well, it's also in this court's Green opinion. I mean, the facts are very similar. I haven't looked at the expert's affidavit in the Green opinion, but it looks like the testimony is pretty much identical on both value and also amount of production in the time period. So if you just look at the deeds, it's clear that she wasn't even thinking about the oil and gas under this Tesco tract in 1984 when she deeded the north and the south tract out. This is your perfect example of strip and gore doctrine. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you cite to the legal precedent of if it looks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck. I mean, this is strip and gore. I mean, this is what we learned. And so,
is it not correct, though, that in Green we were dealing with a transfer that did not include the reservation of, or the conditional waiver that we actually have here?
I don't think we have a conditional waiver here. I will say in the Green case, it dealt with a road, and so there was no access to be able to drill in the road.
Right. The deed for 360 deeded everything.
Right.
Okay. But didn't give any kind of access because 360 was going to be built on the top of it.
Right.
Okay.
I don't think there's a conditional waiver in this case. If you look at the actual deed, the 1964 deed, it's one sentence. It's on page 49 of the record. And it says, it's the reservation of oil and gas rights. It's the exclusion of the access, ingress and egress. And so it says, grantors reserve unto themselves, their heirs and assigns, the right to all oil and gas in and under the lands herein conveyed, but expressly waive all rights of ingress and egress for the purposes of drilling or for producing oil and gas from the surface of the lands herein conveyed, comma, provided that wells open in the lands may be bottomed on these lands. That last phrase modifies the first clause saying I reserve the rights to oil and gas. We know that because it makes sense. I'll keep my oil and gas if I can bottom a well, because I own it, right next to it, under your strip. But if I can't, then I don't reserve my oil and gas rights.
What about,
there's a high voltage power line in the middle of the easement. Yes.
What about the idea that she could have accessed the Crawford tract by going across the street, even though she didn't, I don't know if she owned any property across that road or not, but what about the idea that we have to look at it more broadly than just assuming that the only way she could have been contemplating a slant well back in 1964 was from the land that she later conveyed in 84?
There's nothing in the record that says there was access to the strip other than from the north or south tracks.
But is there anything in the record that says that there couldn't be?
Well,
I mean, because that's Mr. Crawford's argument, right?
Well, and there's a picture that does have Matlock Road there, but if you look at the picture, there's no access from Matlock Road into this easement, into this Tesco track. In fact, there is pedestrian walkways right there, and so presumably you would have to drive a tractor trailer up Matlock and then into this Tesco easement with a high voltage power line in the middle of it, and then drive that all the way down this strip to what, drill a well?
Well, I guess if I understand, and Mr. Marriott can correct me and reply, but I guess what I'm envisioning his argument to be is that you could go across Matlock Road, have a drill site there, and slant it kind of under Matlock Road, where it'll bottom out at some portion of that Crawford tract.
She didn't own any property on either Matlock Road or on the other side of Matlock Road. So.
In this case, really, sorry, go ahead.
No.
Go ahead. About where we take the snapshot, whether we take the snapshot in 1984 or we take the snapshot in 1964, and they're assuming that because there was some benefit created by virtue of the reservation in 1964, that intent carries forward into 1984.
I guess that's their argument. I think you look at 1984. That's at the time the deed was done. To transfer the north tract and the south tract away from this small, tiny little right of oil and gas minerals.
Is there any authority out there that talks about their argument from the standpoint of, well, at one point in time there was an expression, an intent that we were going to create some benefit to ourselves, and that intent carries forward into a subsequent conveyance and militates against the strip and gore doctrine later?
Well, I mean, yes, Your Honor. And so from the Green opinion, in this court's opinion from a couple of months ago, this court said were we not to apply the strip and gore doctrine because the mineral tract was too large, albeit practically worthless for development purposes in 1972, we would have to conclude that Center Company intended to retain ownership indefinitely in a property interest to which it has that was inaccessible and then undevelopable, with a future hope that one day it would benefit from that interest, either via pooling or the advent of technology. Also, from the Glover opinion from Texarkana, it states, while the tract may be valuable now, and certainly the mineral production proceeds from the Campbell tract of the last 70 years is quite valuable, the land underneath the railroad right-of-way was little perceived value in 1904, before oil was discovered in the area. So you look at the deed in 1984, and what happens after it, all the production and everything that happened after it is completely irrelevant.
Now, I understand that argument. I'm talking about looking at what happened before the deed in 1984.
Well, all we have is the Tesco deed, which was, I'm sure, drafted by the Tesco company. And they say that they've waived the right of ingress and egress to develop minerals on this electric right-of-way because we have a huge power line up there. It's a 50-yard easement. And that's, I think you have to get to 1984, right? And what was out there at the time? And so this gets to, they quoted the dominant estate, you know, has the minerals of the dominant estate. There's an exception to that, which is reasonable use, which is that a mineral owner can't interfere with the landowner's reasonable use that's in operation at the time. So here in 1984, we have a 50-yard easement with a high-voltage power line running down the middle of it. So you have 25 yards on each side of it. We have to look at the reality of the time to determine what her intent is. Was the intent really that she thought she could take a helicopter and drop a rig within 12 yards of that power line, put up the rigging with two men at the top of it to put a 35-foot pipe up on a metal rigging and to be able to slide down into this well? Is that really what her intent was? That's what their argument leads to. The only way that, you know, that their argument says that, well, you can march out there in the middle of this electric power easement and drill, and that just makes no sense. For practical reasons, that they would never happen because it's a high voltage power line. And secondly, the spacing reasons. I mean, in Texas, to be able to drill a well in that time period is about 450 yards from the property line. This easement's only 150 feet, not 450 feet.
Just out of curiosity, and nobody's addressed this, but you raise a question. Are there any regulatory requirements that forbid the erection of something like a well or something of that nature within a certain frame, you know, with a certain distance of a high power line for purposes of arcing or anything of that nature?
We can certainly supplement with that. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know. I can't imagine that there wouldn't be some federal or state regulation. I do know that on spacing regulations, now for the local rules, it's about 330 feet from the property line, which is about, what, 110 yards? So this easement's only 50 yards. So you can't drill a well within the property line of this easement. So just from pure spacing requirements, you can't do it. Your Honor raises a good point. I'm sure there are regulations that say you can't put up a metal rig right next to a high-voltage power line. I would think that would make sense, that there would be some sort of regulation, or at least you have to go somewhere and ask for permission. And I'm sure Tesco would be in here getting a TRO, not here, but downstairs, getting a TRO if they saw someone bringing a helicopter and bringing a metal rig that close to their power lines. So
how are we to, so you get a chance to address this before rebuttal, how are we to consider McGregor's affidavit, which is filed in response to Crawford's motion for summary judgment? It's not filed in support of XTO's no evidence motion for summary judgment. How are we to do that? It's clearly an opposing affidavit with regard to Crawford's motion for summary judgment. Traditional.
First of all, because there are cross motions for summary judgment, it expands the scope of review of what the trial court and this court can review with regard to granting summary judgments. In this court's Green opinion, It sets
forth. But is not the purpose of the 7-day rule, the 21-day rule, is that not the purpose, a due process purpose, which allows for a reasonable opportunity to rebut?
Well, certainly, if they needed more time, they could have asked for it. And here, they had an unfiled or unverified request for continuance. The trial court denied it. They haven't appealed that issue. They haven't complained about the trial court not giving them more time to go get an expert to be able to produce the kind of evidence that XDO produced and filed in the court.
Did XTO ever say that it wanted to use the McGregor affidavit in support of its motion rather than just in support of the response?
Yes. In response to their motion to strike, it brought out the fact that the court could
consider. There's one paragraph, and that's where they're saying we want to use this in support of our XTO's motion rather than just in support of response, that one paragraph in their response to the Crawford's objection.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would also note that we actually filed that affidavit twice. We filed it in response to their traditional motion, in response to their no evidence motion. Their motion to strike only dealt with the affidavit attached to their traditional motion. They never complained about the affidavit attached to the no evidence motion.
Well, their objection doesn't raise the issue that the affidavit was filed too late. It just raises evidentiary objections and then asks for a 166AG continuance, doesn't it?
I think they did raise an issue of being able to rely on it. But in any event, this court's holding in Green says, when both parties move for summary judgment, the trial court grants one motion and denies the other, which is the case here, the reviewing court should review both parties' summary judgment evidence, determine all questions presented, and render the judgment the trial court should have rendered. And that's just, I mean, we've got also other cases we've cited in our brief for this proposition of an expanded scope of review when you dealt with cross motions for summary judgment. If they have an issue with it, they should have come forward and complained about timing, said we need more time to be able to rebut it, or give us another 21 days, or whatever it is, and then give the kind of things you have to give in that sort of motion, like make it verified and show due diligence and all the other stuff. They didn't do any of that. I mean, they filed an unverified request and the court denied it.
Are you conceding that the affidavit in support of XTO's motion for summary judgment was filed late, or that it just automatically goes into the record for us to consider when we're dealing with cross motions for summary judgment?
Oh, I don't concede that it was filed late because there were cross motions for summary judgment and it was attached to our response. And the scope of review for a trial court or this court is you look at all the evidence and you decide the issues presented in the motions. If you were to look at it like they never filed a motion and it was just our motion, then in that case it would be late because it was filed within 21 days of the hearing. But the court can review late filed evidence, and then both parties agree. May I finish my question?
Sure.
Both parties agree that the court considered it. So the issue is, did the court err in reviewing it? And no, the court has the authority to review late filed evidence. And the remedy is, well, ask for a continuance properly, and then if the court doesn't give you a continuance, then you complain about that. And so we've set out kind of the flow chart of issues in our brief on that issue.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Marriott, reply.
To address your question about the snapshot in 1984. We agree that the Strip and Gore doctrine must be evaluated in 1984. But the value of those mineral rights then is established as it is at any point by the right to try to extract those minerals. If you own mineral rights, they have value. And that value will always be of benefit to you as long as you can access it, which leads us back to the access issue. Access is just one of the things used to determine benefit or importance to know what the party's intent was. And opposing counsel argued that Mary Ruth Crawford wasn't thinking. But she, in the deed, her intent was stated to convey only the north and south tracks. That's what she said, I'm conveying. What we're trying to do here today is determine whether or not to expand that intent. XTO has the burden to show that she did intend to convey that additional tract. And if she wasn't thinking about it, then how could she think I'm trying to convey this?
Do you agree that does the record reflect that the easement's actually 50 yards across?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Okay.
I assume.
And the other thing is, do you agree, and this would be in 1984, okay, that the tract was 50 yards across and that there was a high power electrical line that was running down the center of it for purposes of Tesco's provision and delivery of electricity?
I'm honestly unsure of the voltage of the power line. I assume that it was somewhat powerful. But that's really a question of fact that just comes down to whether or not the drilling could occur. If she had those rights to try to negotiate with Tesco and see if they could work things out, that's the right to try as well, the right to try to get those minerals. And as long as she had some way to try to get those minerals, then it had benefit or importance to her. The question here is whether there was an entire cessation of benefit or importance, whether the mineral estate was wholly worthless to her due to an entire lack of access. Because if there is some access whatsoever, then how can this court say that she had no reason to not convey it? The spacing requirements have a similar issue. It's, we don't know. She has the right to try to work within spacing requirements. And looking at all of these factual questions as to how she could possibly drill raises the bigger issue of, if we're going to say that your land has no benefit or importance to you if you can't drill a well right on it, then what does that do to the Texas oil and gas industry? Because there are so many restrictions on what you can possibly do, and it just seems unreasonable to say that an oil and gas interest does not have benefit or importance to its owner just because you might have some difficulty accessing it. As long as you have a possible way of accessing it, it's not wholly worthless. Going to the motion to strike the McGregor affidavit, Crawford moved to strike it because it was filed late and argued that it should not be able to be considered in support of XTO's motion. XTO could have filed a motion to admit late filed evidence. They did not. They had the opportunity to do so, but they did not. XTO is instead trying to ram this evidence before the court by saying that the court can consider both sides' summary judgment evidence. However, both sides are to file their own summary judgment evidence 21 days before. Our summary judgment evidence filed 21 days before can be considered against theirs. Theirs can be considered against ours. But rebuttal evidence is not the evidence you are using to support your summary judgment. It's not your summary judgment evidence. It's your rebuttal evidence to someone else's summary judgment.
Is there anything in the court's, trial court's orders indicating that it did consider the McGregor affidavit in support of XTO's motion?
The transcript of that hearing indicates that the court did consider the evidence, and the parties have agreed to that in their briefing. XTO, when arguing that because the trial court considered it, it must have granted leave, therefore admitting that the trial court did consider it. We say, though, that because you did not request leave and because the trial court did not indicate that it was granting leave, it merely thought that the evidence wasn't late, incorrectly based on XTO's legal arguments, that there was no grant of leave, and so the evidence was late, and any consideration of it would be improper. And further, that evidence must be considered in the light most favorable to Crawford on a summary judgment motion, as we have here. And so, if anything, that evidence can only show that there was value, there was benefit or importance to the Crawford tract, because it was worth something and not nothing.
Thank you, counsel. Gentlemen, your case is submitted. We appreciate the argument. It's been helpful, and we are going to take a couple of minute break for another panel change, and then we'll be back for argument or 3 o'clock case. You're welcome to stick around and listen, or you may be excused. Thank you.